Hello, you are listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
And I'm Arman Rana.
I'm Ben Nelson.
And I'm Milena Carrasco. It's Thursday, June 11th at 5:03 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. On today's show, we're going to hear an interview I did with the candidate running in the Vancouver Kingsway riding in our federal fall election. Lawrence Taylor is the candidate running for the Green Party, and I spoke with him about the differences between the federal and municipal Green parties and why he believes people in the Vancouver Kingsway community are going to vote Green this time in a historically dominated NDP riding.
Today, we will also be taking a closer look at where Vancouver is at with its citywide plan. Alex spoke with Vancouver municipal reporter Francis Bula about what exactly a citywide plan even is and why it's so important. But first, we have some local headlines. Let's start with our sports expert, Ben Nelson.
Thanks, Armand. So the Vancouver Canucks just signed Michael Ferland. Ferland is from Swan River, Manitoba. He was signed to a four-year, $14 million contract. Canucks analyst Gio Palermo noted, quote, "Nobody would have imagined that the man who once antagonized the Canucks in their last playoff appearance is now a key piece in their lineup," end quote. Ferland is a perfect combination of grit and skill. He is the size of Canucks fourth liner Jay Beagle with the endearing peskiness of winger Antoine Roussel. He can also score. Last year, he scored exactly 40 points with the Hurricanes over the season. Because Ferland used to antagonize the Canucks so much when he played for the Flames, some fans weren't happy he was signed. However, in my opinion, signing him really shows the Canucks management are fully committed to making the playoffs this year. Welcome, Michael.
Welcome, Michael.
Welcome, Michael.
Speaking of hockey, you could be hailing an Uber to the puck drop this year.
Nice.
As the CBC reports, ICBC has completed the insurance portion of its proposed ride-hailing legislation at long last.
Yay!
That means starting September 3rd, the Passenger Transportation Board will be able to take applications from ride service companies. This, however, doesn't mean you'll be able to become a driver right away. One of the requirements of the new legislation is that you need a Class 4 commercial driver's license. A regular Class 5 is not sufficient. Lyft, for example, has not previously operated with such a requirement, so it's not clear if they will move into Vancouver at all. Uber became public in May of this year, and it was rocked by strikes to protest unfair pay, poor working conditions, and a lack of transparency from Uber. We'll have to wait and see if the long-awaited regulations in Vancouver are successful in creating an equitable yet successful ride-hailing ecosystem.
All right, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Those were your headlines for the week. Let's turn to Vancouver's citywide plan.
That's right, it's the citywide plan. So if you've been following local news this week, you probably noticed this phrase coming up. There were a number of stories published about it. Vancouver hasn't had a citywide plan made since the 1920s, so it's been 100 years or so, just under. So today I wanted to take a look at what is a citywide plan. What does that mean? So a citywide plan is a guiding vision for the city. Okay, so what does that actually mean? What is a guiding vision for the city? So to answer this question and to explain a bit about why the city plan is important and where it's at in the development process, I called Francis Bula, a Globe and Mail reporter and professor with the UBC School of Journalism, as well as many other credentials, to talk about the citywide plan. And let's turn to that piece because I think it says it all. So let's take a listen. This is Francis Bula on the citywide plan. All right. That was some really beautiful music by Blue Dot Sessions. So we had the wrong file there. Not a big deal. This hardly ever happens. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We are just going to listen to a couple ads, and then I'm going to get up the proper piece, which is a conversation with City Hall reporter Francis Bula on Vancouver's citywide plan. So let's listen to a PSA, and we'll be right back.
Creative BC and the City of Vancouver have announced the Vancouver Music Fund
can
to elevate the voices of Indigenous and underrepresented artists and groups.
Please.
Apply for funding to create demo recordings, music videos, and industry development projects. Learn more at creativebc.com and apply now until July 24th. Get your applications in today.
No, because I didn't have the speakers.
Creative BC and the City of Vancouver have announced the Vancouver Music Fund to elevate the voices of Indigenous and underrepresented artists and groups. Apply for funding to create demo recordings, music videos, and industry development projects. Learn more at creativebc.com and apply now until July 24th. Get your applications in today.
Are you energetic, mature, and committed to making a difference in the life of an Indigenous youth? Then you'd make a great mentor. Volunteer mentors at Vancouver's Urban Native Youth Association help youth recognize their many strengths and words towards future goals. To learn more about how you can become a mentor to a deserving young person, please visit unya.bc.ca/mentorship.
Feels like a vortex, all covered in Gore-Tex. Don't look at your text.
Do you like that? How about that? Mondays, 5 p.m. Deliberate Noise. Nina Panini, special guest Claire. Local, new, hot, upcoming shows, toilets, friendship. Mondays at 5. CITR. Be there. Be there.
One, two.
Be there.
Said that people disappoint, but pizza is eternal. That adage is being put to the test with Canadians weighing in on pizza, love, and slice etiquette. 6 in 10 Canadians have some type of relationship deal breaker when it comes to pizza, but 1 in 3 have no pizza love limits at all. The top deal breaker was eating pizza in bed at 18%, and closely behind was anchovies on pizza at 17%. Next up were picks the cheese off at 10%, eats pizza with a knife and fork at 8%, uses too much garlic dipping sauce at 7%, puts pineapple on pizza at 6%, doesn't eat the crust at 6%, and eats it cold at 4%. So cuddle up on the couch and share some za and some love.
All right, and we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Thanks for bearing with us through a couple tech issues. I'm going to turn things over to Milena as we're going to actually hear an interview she did, and then we'll hear an interview with Francis Bula on the citywide plan shortly after. Milena?
Awesome. So this week's interview is coming to you all the way from my hometown, South Burnaby, also known in the electoral district as Vancouver Kingsway. I talked to Lawrence Taylor, as I previously mentioned, the Green Party candidate for this riding, and we chatted about who he is, what he stands for, and what he doesn't.
Let's hear that piece.
Can you hear me through your headphones?
Perfect.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, awesome. I can hear you. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me this evening. Can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about who you are?
Sure. So I'm Lawrence Taylor. I'm the candidate for the Green Party in Vancouver Kingsway. I've lived in Vancouver for about 16 years and in the riding for about the past six. I was actually born in the riding. I'm 61 years old. I work in an area called regulatory affairs in pharmaceuticals, medical devices, and biologics. And I started out my career in Toronto, but moved back to Vancouver in about 2003. And that's what I do currently. And this is my first time running for anything.
Cool. Our new show is Vancouver-based and focuses on the local. So we do a lot of coverage on Vancouver's municipal government rather than our provincial or federal governments.
Okay.
As a politician running to become a federal MP in a Vancouver-Burnaby riding, can you explain for our listeners how you're going to represent their local interests in Ottawa?
The key thing, I think, is to listen and to be available for whatever problems they have. That's probably the job one for MP, for any of the constituents. In terms of issues, things that I think are close to my heart, being in Vancouver and probably to others, are things like affordability, the rental market, sustainable development, transit, the opioid crisis. I think those are all things where the federal government has an influence that affect things municipally. Also, I think infrastructure, and I did mention transit, yeah. So I think those are all things where all levels of government sort of intersect.
Okay. It's interesting because in Vancouver City Hall, there's actually only one municipal political party that has a provincial or federal counterpart, and that party is, of course, the Green Party.
Right.
Can you explain what the relationship is between the Vancouver Greens and the Federal Green Party of Canada?
So all three are separate organizations, and so, you know, they have a separate focus. If you're a member of one, you're not necessarily a member of the other, but generally we are. So we do pool resources, we do talk, and we do influence each other's policies to some extent, for sure.
Okay. And Vancouver City Hall recently voted to declare a climate emergency.
Right.
They also passed six big moves to try to address this climate change in the city. I was looking through their website, and some of them are introducing pollution-free cars, trucks, and buses, and making walkable complete communities.
Right.
As a politician with the Green Party, what are your thoughts on these climate change actions?
Well, I think we support those. We just released our climate action plan a little while ago called Mission Possible. And part of that is switching over to electric cars and making EVs available and charging. Other things that we're talking about is increasing funding for transit, for that sort of thing. So those sorts of policies dovetail quite well. We also have a section there dealing with what we call all hands on deck, which is engaging municipalities and community organizations to do things that will address climate change and carbon footprint. So what City Hall is proposing is right in line with what's in our climate action plan.
The Vancouver Kingsway riding you're running in, it's been historically dominated by the NDP.
Right.
Why do you think constituents are going to vote green this time?
Well, that's a good question. It has been historically left of center for a long time. In terms of Greens, I think people automatically assume that if there is a vote to be taken, it's from the NDP, and the polling bears that out somewhat, but it doesn't always. As we saw in the provincial election, that the Greens took as many votes from the Liberals as they did from the NDP, where they won. So I think that's one assumption that we have to be careful about. The second thing is I think the NDP has a branding issue when it comes to green policy because they are somewhat related to or spring out of the labor movement. They have a sort of a contradiction, whereas, you know, they may want to be green, but they also have to worry about union jobs. And we see that in provincial politics. So the NDP are going ahead with fracking and LNG, whereas the Greens would never do that. So if you are an NDP voter or if you're even a Liberal voter and that's something you just can't live with, then the Greens are a place for you. So, you know, I'm not sure that it will always come from the NDP. I think a lot of it will. But I think that's where we can differentiate ourselves. We're not beholden to corporations. We're not beholden to unions. So we can make the decisions free of that sort of influence.
Okay. And another question is, how will Canada's new election rules affect the Green Party?
I think it levels the playing field for everybody. So in that sense, I think it'll help us. I think it's going to make it a little easier for people to vote who are not well settled. So things like vouching and that sort of thing will enable more people to vote. So I think in general, it's a positive thing. We're coming from a long ways back from what we had under the Conservatives, but I think it'll help us.
And finally, what are your major issues from your perspective in this federal election?
Well, for me, number one is climate change and sustainability. My point in running is to basically move the conversation for all political parties. Every green vote I get is starting to influence other parties. We see that with the NDP releasing their climate policy and also the Conservatives addressing it, however you want to take that. In terms of local policies, I think housing affordability is important, doing what we can to oppose the Trans Mountain Pipeline. And for me, particularly because I work in pharmaceuticals, I think the opioid crisis is something that we have to worry about very much in Vancouver. So those are sort of the issues that are close to my heart. And I guess on a longer-term scale, I would like to see electoral reform finally come. So I've spent a lot of time in the last few months on that, and I would like to see that come as well.
Awesome. Thanks again for speaking with me, Lawrence Taylor. It's been great, and I hope you have a good evening.
Okay, well, thanks. Thanks for your interest.
All right. And we're back. You were just listening to an interview done by Milena, our News Collective comrade, who interviewed Lawrence Taylor, who is a Green Party candidate who's running in the federal election coming up this fall in the Vancouver Kingsway riding, so which is in Burnaby and Vancouver. So we're going to now try to hear a piece I tried to play earlier, which is on the Vancouver citywide plan, which is going to be voted on next week, whether the city will commit to developing this plan, which is set to take about 3 years. The citywide plan is meant to be a sort of vision for the city, but right now it's really vague and broad. So I wanted to learn a bit more about it and why it's important and how input is being collected from various communities around the city. So I called up Globe and Mail reporter Frances Beulah and spoke with her. So let's take a listen to what she had to say.
Hello? I just, you know, I'm kind of crippled these days, so I just couldn't quite get to the phone in time, but I'm here.
Well, it's nice to talk to you. Did you recently have... If you remember back to Vancouver's municipal election, which happened almost 9 months ago, you probably recall the term citywide plan coming up. Developing a new citywide plan, or a vision for the city of Vancouver as it goes forward, is something former NPA councillor Hector Bremner campaigned on, as did the Vancouver Greens. So soon after our new city council was elected, they voted to direct staff to develop a citywide plan informed by equity, accessibility, spatial justice, and the right to housing. This past Tuesday, July 9th, staff presented their findings to council. Yeah, so as you know, I wanted to chat about city staff's presentation of a proposal for a citywide plan, which they presented to council yesterday. And this citywide plan is estimated to cost like just under $18 million and to take about 3 years to complete. And so the plan has been described as a sort of guiding vision for the city. But I do think a lot of people find that still pretty vague. Could you give a bit of an explanation on how the citywide plan would be implemented once complete, or like an example of how it might be used practically?
Well, it is a bit hard to give details right now because they've deliberately left it kind of high level and vague, precisely so that they could say we are open to whatever the public wants to tell us about. Because, you know, say that like one of the recent planning exercises, not that recent anymore, but in 2011, Vancouver sort of responded to the region's need for a regional plan, the regional growth strategy. And they responded in a way to a population target that they were trying to hit.
Right.
So, you know, clearly planning didn't want to do that this time because you'd have a lot of people saying, well, why is that the target? Why are we trying to do that? So they're leaving it more open than that, although they did cite a number of issues that the city, they feel this, that city residents will have to grapple with. And one councillor, Colleen Hardwick, she said she was objecting to that, saying, well, isn't that setting up a whole bunch of values or targets that you think should shape things? Because, you know, they made reference to the need for climate change and supporting a strong economy and absorbing new residents and, you know, providing a variety of housing and things like that. And, you know, the chief planner, Gil Kelly, responded, well, these are concerns we hear constantly from residents. They are issues that are going to have to be addressed as we go through this planning process, including Indigenous issues as well. So so that's one of the reasons why it sounds vague, is because they're trying not to be too prescriptive. You know, in the past, when they've done community plans, they've gone in with population targets that they're trying to hit for the community. And then that just gets everyone's back up. Like, well, why, how did we come up with this number and why us and why not somebody else and so on? So it is deliberately somewhat vague in order to allow people to have, present all kinds of things and not feel like you're only being asked for a solution to this. How are we going to take in like a million more people or something like that?
Right. And then when Councillor Hardwick voiced that concern, implying that like values might be imposed on residents or things that might be important to citizens like climate change or reconciliation with Indigenous people, would you take that as kind of her sort of voicing the concern she also voiced to Dan Fumano in that Vancouver Sun article that came out last week or a few days ago?
Yeah, where she was sort of saying that, expressing some concern about the reconciliation process and, you know, what it's really all about and so on. I mean, I think it's a bit different in that she was saying, well, you're, you know, listing all these issues as must address issues, and aren't you imposing values?
Yeah.
And the chief planner was saying, we're not imposing them. This is what the community has told us over the years are their concerns. You know, climate change, dealing with a lot of growth and development in Vancouver, how much of that do we want to do? He was saying, we're trying to, you know, put out there the issues that are probably going to come up and have to be addressed
right
some way, in some way or another. So I think it was slightly different, even though the article and then her recent comments both involved some commentary on Indigenous issues. I think they are actually different, what she was saying.
Okay, that's good to, know. How much is zoning part of this citywide plan? Because much of our city is zoned for single-family homes, and that's been attributed to our housing crisis, one of the causes.
Well, that's what a plan is like. I mean,
it's specifically,
you know,
about zoning.
Things. It can talk about transportation, but ultimately, cities control land use. Land use is what dictates how people are going to live in the city and the forms of it. It's not the only thing, but it's huge. I mean, it is the thing that cities govern and regulate, and that creates the conditions for a housing crisis, you know, if it's not done right. So, I mean, there is the YIMBY, the young sort of yes in my backyard movement. They have really focused on zoning and the fact that so many huge swaths of cities are zoned for single family, and what you're seeing is a big push to allow at least some options in single family areas. So like Minneapolis has now zoned to allow duplexes, and quads, I think, or maybe only up to triplexes in any single-family area. And Oregon, the state of Oregon, just mandated that you could have at least, I think, duplexes and triplexes in any city over 25,000 in their single-family zones. So that is one of the pushes. For sure, that is something that's going to be talked about in Vancouver.
Right.
And it's not a... Some people sometimes call it a single-family house ban. It's not a ban. If you're rich enough, you know, buy the whole place and build yourself a Versace mansion, go for it. But, you know, like at least there'd be an option to build a duplex and allow two families with half the income to move into each side.
Right.
And so on.
On the topic of community input, so I watched part of the council meeting on and off yesterday, but I did hear some councillors bring up concern, and Councillor Hardwick in particular, over whether this plan would be top-down or kind of bottom-up intake. And then there were some critiques on Twitter over, you know, whether renters would be included as much as homeowners, because renters, of course, often have to move often because they can't secure rental suites for very long. So... What do you know of the intake process that the city plans?
I'm not totally sure, and that is a dilemma that that all planners are facing these days. It used to be, you know, in the grand revolt against developers and top-down councils in the 1970s, which, you know, Colleen Hardwick's father, Walter, was a part of, neighborhood groups were seen as like kind of these pure forms of democracy that were battling against the forces of evil.
Right.
Increasingly, what we've seen, especially in the last decade, is a lot of people saying, hey, wait a minute, resident associations don't actually represent the city. They tend to represent older, fairly well-established households who, because of the interests that they have, tend to want to preserve their neighborhoods as is and are quite resistant to change. And lots of groups are being left out, not just renters, not just, you know, families who often don't have the time to hang around in council halls for, you know, hours on end, not just, you know, ethnic groups who, especially newer immigrants, who don't feel very comfortable and so on, but also future residents of the city. So that's something that is going to be tricky, that they're going to have to weigh, because, you know, in a city that's rapidly growing, that many people want to move to, should only the existing residents get to have a say? And how much do you count future residents? How much do you count renters? There's a big movement in a lot of cities that is sort of anti-homeowner association and trying to find more of a place for people who don't typically get a say. So that is going to be a real balancing act. And the city acknowledged that very likely existing resident groups are going to be very mobilized. They are going to come out. And what they want to do is try to bring out the voices of some of the people who typically don't show up at City Hall or city meetings. So,
right.
you know, new immigrants whose language skills aren't great, busy young families, indigenous groups, low-income groups, and so on. Other people who live in the city or who would like to live in the city.
Right. So in the past, the city's kind of relied on folks coming to public hearings and things like that to get input. And so now you're saying they're going to have to maybe be a bit more inventive and do more proactive outreach.
They've acknowledged that for a long time.
Right.
I mean, for quite a while, it's been recognized. You know, I would say there's been a growing realization in the last decade that it's a very specific group of people who come out to public hearings.
Mm-hmm.
They're generally opposed to whatever it is. Like, opposition motivates people a lot more than support. And they are people who are in a position to come out and who have, you know, substantial interests that they're trying to protect.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a recognition for a long time. And, since I've been covering the city, they've always also tried to do surveys, like just get a read from the neighborhood in general, you know,
right.
some sort of random survey. So they're not relying just on who comes out to a meeting because that's so unrepresentative. One of the problems that emerged like 10 or 15 years ago was then residents who were really opposed to something were then stacking the surveys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were making
mm-hmm.
sure that, you know, that their group knew about them and were responding to them more than maybe people who were kind of mildly supportive and didn't really follow the city that much. So it's been a real struggle. And again, this is not unique to Vancouver, to
mm-hmm.
try to figure out how do you reach these other groups? How do you know that you get real representation?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that at City Hall, like the kind of the golden rule has been if you get even 30% of the speakers out to a public hearing in support of something, that's really good because supporters typically don't come out. Opponents do. Supporters don't.
Right.
They, you know, a lot of people sit at home thinking, oh, well, this is going to go through and, you know, I don't really need to be there. And then everyone's surprised when something gets turned down because all the opponents came out and none of the supporters did.
Right.
Yeah.
Do most cities with similar populations to Vancouver have citywide plans?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know. Like, a lot of the other municipalities and I think maybe they're required to legally. I should know this after 25 years, but amazingly I don't. But they're required to have an official community plan, whereas the Vancouver, because of the Vancouver Charter, maybe doesn't have to. You know, I have to say, although I think a citywide plan may produce some interesting, productive discussions on where is this city going as a whole, to think it's going to solve all the problems that people think it will is a bit naive. Like, I saw the District of North Vancouver go through a massive, like, process for their new official community plan. 2 or 3 years, thousands of people, they got it passed, they thought they'd done a great job. The very first building that was proposed under the new plan, some 10-story building at the Lynn Valley Mall or something like that, a whole new group came out in opposition saying, we were never consulted, this doesn't conform to the plan, this is bigger than we thought, you know, things like that. So it's not going to resolve, I don't believe, a lot of those issues that people think it will. But I do think that the problem right now is, and why people have latched onto the idea of a plan, is they just can't figure out what the city's overall direction is. And it just seems like things are happening somewhat haphazardly in their eyes.
Right, and when you say direction, are you referring to how houses are built, like how communities are laid out? Like, what do you mean by direction?
Just everything. You know, how many people do we think is the maximum we can pack into this city? What do we think is livable? Do we just keep piling people in for the next 300 years until the whole place looks like Hong Kong? You know, or
mm-hmm.
is there a point at which we say this piece of land has taken as much as it can, and if you put in any more, it is going to become unlivable? I really don't, and I've covered this for a long time, and I've even said to planners, like, the problem is you develop these plans for 30 years at a time. Okay, fine, you absorb 100,000 people in 30 years or whatever, but then what about the next 30 and the 30 after that? Like, you get no sense of what is the ultimate ideal vision for the city where we do accommodate new people? Mm-hmm. You know, we do make a place for those who aren't necessarily in the top income brackets. We do try to have a city that isn't reliant on everyone getting around in some giant 5,000-pound vehicle. You know, we haven't had a sense of what is the overall idea of what Vancouver should become. Like, should it be mostly still somewhat single-family residential neighborhoods with everybody piled onto the arterials? Mm-hmm. Should it be a place where you allow huge amounts of density in a few little places like downtown Oak Ridge, mm-hmm. Joyce Collingwood, and, you know, a couple others, and you preserve it? Are you gradually going to move towards a city where maybe there's a real mix within what were the single-family neighborhoods? Maybe you allow triplexes and quads and small apartment buildings as a mix inside right. of that. You know, do you want to look more like Vienna, or do you want to look more like Hong Kong? I mean, those are the extreme examples, and in some ways we can't totally control the move towards one or the other, but I think people just don't really have a sense of overall where are we going. Like imagine the Vancouver 50 years from now. What does it look like in your mind? And I think people are just, I don't know, you know, like everything just happens so randomly.
But we have in the past been relying on area plans, so mm-hmm. plans that have a sort of direction or vision, guiding vision for certain parts of the city. Do all parts of the city have their own kind of area plans?
Well, you know that Gordon Campbell in the 90s, when there was another housing crisis, he initiated city plan. So there was a big, mm-hmm. huge, long conversation with some big general goals that were agreed on. Where I have to say, it's always easy for people to agree on big general goals. It's mm-hmm. like the building next to them that's always the bigger problem.
Right.
And then from there, they were supposed to proceed to finer plans for each neighborhood. And it just was so expensive and so time-consuming that I think maybe only 4 or 6 neighborhoods plans got done. And then recently, over the last vision years, they also did the West End, Marpole, Commercial Drive, Mount Pleasant. So every area does have sort of an area plan, but some of them are quite vague and unspecific and years old, and others are more updated. And as Dorothy Barkley from Commercial, you know, the Grandview Woodland community pointed out, mm-hmm. when Grandview Woodland did their plan, they were told, well, the population target for this is X. But she said you had no sense at all of what was happening in the rest of the city. Was the rest of the city also mm-hmm. going to be taking, you know, X percent more residents? You know, Y this number for Commercial Drive area and so on?
Right.
So it has been hard for people to kind of figure out in their own heads where is the city going as a whole.
Right. And even with this citywide plan, I believe they intend to consider and incorporate broader regional planning initiatives. I'm wondering if you think that Vancouver's housing crisis is very tied up in our lack of a citywide plan and not having made one since the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. You know, every attractive city around the world that's seeing, you know, people flood in because that's where the jobs are, that's where people want to be. Everyone's having a housing crisis, and it doesn't mm-hmm. seem to matter what their plan is. I mean, Singapore, Hong Kong, Sydney, Los Angeles, Boston, you know, Berlin, where they're talking about freezing rents because mm-hmm. of problems there. You know, there's a change that's happened in cities.
I guess
it used to be people were moving out of them. They were moving to the suburbs, or there was a pattern of settlement that was different. But you've got this incredible crush of people into certain glamour or job-creating or creative class or whatever you want to call it cities, and it's creating incredible pressures.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's basically all I have. I just, you know, we're going to be hearing councillors vote on this issue next week on July 16th, I believe. I'm just wondering, is there any anything you'd tell people to look out for? Or do you want to make any final comments on this topic?
I mean, I think we've heard a lot from the councillors that is interesting. I mean, obviously, like, a lot of people are supporting it. They can't. The Green Party campaigned on it. You know, a lot of the NPA councillors are supportive. They do like the equity language that the planners are using about trying to bring more people into the process, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There is going to be a bit of a tussle, you know, with some people who are going to say, you know, why do we have to make all this change? Like, there's too many people moving in here. It's going to become unlivable. Why don't we just set some limits and just tell other people who want to move here, you're going to have to go, you know, somewhere else in the region. Mm-hmm. That has been a consistent theme for the whole time I've covered the city, is that there are some people who just think we should end immigration or just, you know, stop building to accommodate new people.
Mm-hmm.
And that will come up. But it will be interesting to see what comes out in the end of all this. Because right now it's a very polarized debate over what the solutions are. And I'm hoping that the conversations that people have with each other might be more productive than coming and screaming at public hearings or on Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, so are you sort of thinking it'll be a close vote?
No, I don't think it'll be a close vote at all.
Yeah.
I mean, the only person I've heard who's really objected to the parameters of the program is Colleen Hardwick,
mm-hmm.
Because essentially she doesn't trust staff. I mean, we've heard that in a number of comments that she's made, that she mm-hmm. thinks that they're somehow doing an end run around councillors, or they're coming in with their own values, or they're spending too much money. She's quite critical of staff and doesn't trust them, and so I expect her possibly not to vote for this. I don't
mm-hmm.
know. But certainly everyone else that I've heard from or talked to has indicated that they by and large support it. What will happen with the conclusions is a whole other thing, and I have to say the conclusions, that's something to watch, because my experience of, you know, city planning meetings, you know, one of which happened in my own area, Mount Pleasant, is you get a lot of people come out who say a lot of things, and you can kind of draw different conclusions from depending on who you listen to and so on. So they're going to have to, staff are going to have to work really hard to prove that they documented and measured what people said.
Mm.
It can't be just some planner's notes about what he or she thinks they heard during various meetings. Like, there's going to have to be some real proof that, you know, a majority of people support this measure or that measure.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me, Frances.
Okay, good luck.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
All right. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alex DeBoer. You just heard an interview I did with Globe and Mail reporter Frances Bula. She wrote a story that was published on Monday about Vancouver's citywide plan. City Council heard from staff on how their research into the citywide plan has been going over the last 7 or 8 months. And the City Council will be voting on whether or not to take staff's advice to develop a citywide plan that will take about 3 years and just under $18 million and will create a guiding vision for the city. And if you just heard the piece, Frances Bula unpacked a bit of what exactly that meant. But I just wanted to comment on some of the main sort of takeaways I had from talking to her. Going into it, I watched part of council, like, I watched a fair bit of it, but on and off when council was hearing this report from staff. And so I got a sort of sense of what was happening. And one of the things that did stand out to me from watching was Councillor Hardwick sort of commenting on or asking staff whether this was a kind of top-down intake approach or a sort of bottom-up intake approach, because basically a big part of this citywide plan is staff getting input from the Vancouver communities. And there's a lot of different communities, right? Her concern seemed to be that perhaps staff would be imposing their values onto communities and kind of framing what they heard in a sort of biased way. And as Frances said, from her perspective, Colleen Hardwick has a pretty clear distrust of staff, which I think is probably fair to say at this point. So that was kind of her concern. But then some folks on Twitter were saying, such as Derek O'Keefe, who ran as a city council candidate for COPE in this past municipal election, that he was concerned that perhaps if the city is mostly listening to neighborhood associations, so, you know, groups of people who have formed communities in neighborhoods, normally who are homeowners, such as, like, you know, the Kits Neighborhood Association, Grandview Woodland, whatever, versus, like, that their voice would be heard more strongly because they have these formed groups who are vocal and make it a priority to attend public hearings or whatever, versus renters who maybe are more transient. I think it's fair to say are more transient because rent is precarious when you're a renter. Housing is precarious when you're a renter. Renters are less likely to live in one place for a super long time and to form roots and to perhaps join these neighborhood associations. So I thought that was an interesting and valid criticism. But something Frances Bueller brought up that I think was also really interesting and added to what the conversation I've heard around the citywide plan is just sort of how staff will collect input. So not necessarily who they will listen to, but how they will listen. So, okay, if they're going to listen to if they're trying to listen to everyone, that's one thing to have kind of make that a priority. But then how exactly you weigh things. So as Frances said, staff are going to have to be really careful to take really clear documentation of the input they get and really be able to back up why they chose to believe or prioritize certain input over others, because there's going to be a lot of groups in the city who are going to say, hey, my voice wasn't heard. Hey, why wasn't my voice prioritized over this person's voice or this group's voice? So rather than thinking that, you know, councillors are going to be conflicted over voting on this citywide plan and that it will be a close vote, it'll probably pass pretty close to unanimously next week. But rather the kind of conflict and tension we'll see will be from groups within the city once the plan is developed and as it's being developed. So Frances is kind of saying there may be a lot of tensions over basically people saying they're not being heard or they're not being prioritized. And so, yeah, the way staff intake people's voices has diversified over the years, as she mentioned, which I thought was interesting. So, like, it's not just going out to City Hall when there are public meetings, which are, you know, only every once in a while, but also, like, now city staff do surveys and they'll perhaps be going into communities. Like, they're taking different tactics to try and reach different people where they're at, and people who are less likely or less able to get out to City Hall and speak to councillors at a public hearing setting. So I don't know. I thought Frances had some really interesting takeaways, and I found talking to her to be pretty helpful. So I hope it was helpful to everyone who was listening if you were kind of still a little bit vague on what exactly the citywide plan was kind of what the key concerns are around it. So anyway, we'll see if this plan passes. I think it will next week. It's being voted on in July 16th. And then over the next few years, we'll have to be watching how city staff take collect input from citizens. And yeah. So anyway, we're in our last 5 minutes. We're just going to do a really quick conversation with News Collective comrade Milena Carrasco, whose name I almost pronounced correctly.
Almost.
Almost. And she wrote a piece for the UBC, which was published actually yesterday online. So she's a reporter here for CITR News, but also venturing into UBC's really exceptional student newspaper, the UBC. So I wanted to take a minute to just highlight her work. So Milena, what's the title and sort of subject of this piece that you just had published?
So the title is Make Believe, The Secret Library of M. Prudhomme Forges, A New Way of Presenting Art.
Sick.
So pretty much what it's about is, I talked to one of the curators of this art gallery, Heather Jessup, who also curated this with Claire Battershield. And so pretty much they made this art gallery based on or with the all of these items that were magically appeared in a crate on the doorstep of a bishop. His name is very long, but I will try my best. Bishop of Prince Albert Dios, Joseph Henry Prudhomme. And yeah, pretty much this box just landed on his doorstep, and he opened it, and all the things that were in it, all these objects, the only unifying factor was that they were all fake. So this was interesting, and why...
This is real?
Yeah, this is real. This is real. And so he was
And this
like,
was in the 20s?
Yes.
This bishop got this box of fake stuff.
Yes.
Okay.
And so there's some... I was talking to Heather, and she said that I would ask her why. Why of him, of all people, and it was because maybe he was cultured. He came from a wealthy family. His family was actually the first in Canada to make the first brewery. So they had a lot of money, and yeah, I don't know. And so pretty much the gallery is a double fake. So not only are the objects being presented fake, but these objects were actually sent out to artists, or the descriptions of the objects, I should say. And then the artists sent the letters back that Heather and Claire sent to them first with designs. And so not only do we have on display an array of fake items, but behind every item is a story. And these fake stories kind of made me think, or the conversation that Jessup and I ended up having was about how we believe the information that we take. What is believe? What does it mean to believe? And what does it mean when something that we think is supposed to be real ends up being fake? And we got into fake media news, and yeah.
Interesting, yeah. So, definitely.
You never know.
Some lessons there. Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering, when you say fake objects, like, what is a fake object?
A replica, I guess, would be the most.
Right, but, like, so what did this bishop get in his box? Like, they're real. These items are real in that they're tangible.
Yes.
Or, like, what is an example of an item that's been made for this exhibit?
Yeah, sorry.
That's fake.
So one of them would be a, let me bring up the actual fact, but one of them is, I guess, a script.
Okay.
It was a Chinese script, and all of these can be found in other museums, like the real authentic versions, but have been forged. So
okay.
Actually, here's a better example. A better example would be of artwork that was forged by Sarah Riel. And so a lot of Sarah Riel's work can't really be found nowadays. And there was actually an artist, and this is a real story, an artist who... an indigenous artist who wanted to see her work represented. And she couldn't find it. It wasn't easily accessible. So she forged really well forged, a piece of Sarah Riel just because she wanted representation. And so, yeah, I don't know. In that way, it kind of makes you see fake things in a different light. It's not always because, I don't know, I feel like we see fake or the make-believe in a way where it's kind of like pretentious or like in a bad connotation. But it's not always that. Sometimes you just want to make it like more accessible or... I don't know.
Right, yeah. And, like, if you can't find it, you want to find it. Like,
yeah, you want to see it, you know?
Yeah.
You want to see the physical representation of whatever it is you want to see.
Right,
and whether
right.
it's fake or not, as long as it's there, you feel good.
Sounds like there are some layers to this exhibit.
Oh, yeah.
There's
so you should...
Some takeaways.
Check it out.
So where is this exhibit, and when can people check it out?
This exhibit... is going to be on display at the Vancouver Public Library Central Branch, and it's going to be on until the 15th.
So it's on now until August 15th?
Sorry, August 20th.
August 20th, okay, so people have a little more time. That's cool.
Yeah.
And it's just like regular hours? It's kind of just in the open?
Yeah, and it's going to be on the upper ninth floor.
Okay, cool. And then if people want to read your article, they can go to www. Do people still say that anymore? No. They just don't say the W.
W times three.
Do people do that? Like, that's old, right?
I mean,
I think people just say, like, ubc.ca.
All right.
Anyway, go to ubc.ca and look for an article by Milena Carrasco called Make Believe the Secret Library of M. Prudhomme Forges, a New Way of Presenting Art. That's it for Democracy Watch for today. Thank you so much for listening. Check out our podcast, Seeking Office, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next week at the same time, Thursday at 5 p.m., with more local news. And please stay tuned for the Spencer Latu Show, which is coming up next. Bye, guys. Thanks for listening.
Bye.